want to take you back to your elementary science class, and I need your help here. Have you guys ever learned about metamorphosis? Okay, all right, I see a few people. So this is a really, really easy quiz, all right? A caterpillar is a caterpillar, right? And then it transforms into a cocoon or a chrysalis, right? And then what happens after that? It transforms into a okay. I guess the answers are on the screen. It's great. But a couple weeks ago, do you ever just like wake up in the middle of the night and your mind gets stuck on something you're thinking too deeply about that has no reason to be thinking about it? My mind was stuck on metamorphosis. And so for the past 3 weeks, I have just been thinking about this process of how a caterpillar turns into a butterfly. And when we grow up in elementary school and we learn about this process, it's very cut and dry. It's like, yeah, it makes complete sense that one organism starts as a moldy looking worm and somehow ends up in this like cocoon thing and becomes a completely different insect. Yeah, totally makes sense. But as I've been thinking about this process, I'm like, no, wait, back up. You're telling me a worm can become a completely different insect just by like hanging out in a cocoon? You're telling me that in this cocoon, that all of those legs on that caterpillar somehow becomes like six legs and wings, and its diet changes and its bones are crushed and reformed? I've been in a vortex of metamorphosis lately, but I think that this is such a good image of what we celebrate on Easter. Because on Easter, we celebrate the fact that we were once that caterpillar. We were once this creation that maybe didn't look the way it should. We were stuck in sin, we were stuck in shame, and God, out of his love for us, sent his son. And his son took on that sin and that shame, and by his death, we have been freed. And then 3 days later, he rises from the grave. So not only has our debt been paid, but we are now welcome to live in his victory and to be transformed. And we're somehow made into that beautiful butterfly. But here's the thing where I get hung up on butterflies. You see, caterpillars, they live in this world of food scarcity. Like, they themselves are looking for their next meal, all the while being another animal's next meal. They live in this world of competition. They live in this world of uncertainty, and they're transformed into this beautiful new creation. And they get sent back into this one. They get sent back into the world of food scarcity. They get sent back into a world of brokenness. And this is often the tension I feel with Easter. Like, we come to this moment where, man, like, it feels so good to be transformed and for Christ to make us new, and we're living as a butterfly. And then Monday hits and we're like, well, back at my job, back at school, back with the endless to-do list of things, back with all of the brokenness that I'm rubbing up against. How do we go from this really high high back into the world of brokenness? And this is the question that I'm asking tonight. How do we live as a new creation? How do we live as a new creation who is entering back into the world where we rub against brokenness? And to answer this question, we're going to be diving into 2 Corinthians. And so if you have your Bible with you, go ahead and flip to 2 Corinthians chapter 2. And as you turn there, I want to provide you a little bit of background. 2 Corinthians is a letter written by Paul, and Paul is writing to a church located in the city of Corinth. So this is in the Roman Empire. Corinth is the third largest city. So this is about a town of 100,000 people, so about half the size of Sioux Falls, okay? And the church in Corinth had maybe 50 to 100 people in it. So look at everybody in this room. You are the church in Corinth. This would be the representation. So Christians made up 1%, if that, of the population of Corinth. Now, Corinth was known for being a trade city. They were located near a couple of different ports, and so there were a lot of wealthy merchants that worked there. But it wasn't the trade and the wealth that made Corinth distinct. It was their worship. You see, the Romans in Corinth, They worshiped the goddess Aphrodite. Aphrodite is the goddess of love, sex, and fertility. And even for us coming in a culture where sexual expression is viewed as something normal, like you turn on a TV show and you're probably going to see some type of sexual expression, the problem became that Corinth was known to the degree and to this horrendous place of sexual expression. So many of the things that we would consider to be morally corrupt, just flat out wrong, ethically, like to the core of our being, like we don't even want to be associated with, Corinth would celebrate in their worship. Just give you a few examples. If you were to go to the temple of Aphrodite, you would often find temple prostitutes. One of the ways that you worshiped Aphrodite was by sleeping with a temple prostitute. Not only was that normal, but that was seen as something holy, something set apart, something sacred. We consider prostitution illegal. It was normal in Corinth to practice incest. You could say it and nobody would even bat an eye. We don't even consider that illegal, but to the core of our being, that just rubs us wrong. The degree of sexual expression was horrendous. And look in this room, you are the number of Christians in Corinth. You are the 1%. Paul is writing to a church that is discouraged, that is trying their best to live as a beautiful butterfly in a world of caterpillars. And so as we open chapter 2, we're going to see the first way that Paul tries to encourage this church to live as transformed people. So the first way Paul does this is that he invites the church to be centered on the resurrection of Christ. What does this mean? What does it mean to be centered on Christ's resurrection? The first part is that it means we're in alignment. Like, it means we're laser focused. We're not veering to the left or to the right. We are in alignment on his resurrection. But this isn't something we just talk about. It's something we participate in. The death of Christ can't just be words that come out of our mouth, but it's a death that we also participate in. And if you jump down to verse 14, Paul explains this with an image. He says, "But thanks be to God, who always leads us as captives in Christ's triumphal procession and uses us to spread the aroma of the knowledge of him everywhere." It was Roman tradition that when they would win a war, they'd come back and have a huge parade, a huge triumphal procession. And this parade would have a very specific order to it. The people in the front would be your local government officials. So they'd be like the mayor of Rome, maybe the governor. They'd be the people that were leading the parade. Behind them, you'd have a marching band. So a bunch of people playing instruments and celebrating. Behind them, you would have the soldiers that fought for Rome. And they would be carrying with them anything that they had won or stolen, anything that was valuable from another country that they could take back with them, whether it was money, treasure, or maybe another person. Behind these soldiers were people called captives. The captives were different governing officials of other countries or prisoners of war that Rome had captured. And these captives, as they're walking into this city, they're walking towards their execution. They're in this parade, and everything they see and hear is about the victory of Rome, and every step they take closer and closer to their final destination is one more step closer to death. And as they keep walking, they are ushering in the priests of Rome. And these priests would have these censers with them. And so this aroma would be behind the captives. The captives are ushering in this smell of victory, as if the sights and the sounds weren't enough. They're now ushering in this smell. And this smell is ushering in Caesar, who is seated in his glory. Paul is telling us that there is a similar parade going on. That because Christ is victorious, that we are rejoicing, and Christ has this seat of honor, and we are giving him the glory and the praise. And Paul tells us that we are also in this parade. But Paul tells us that we're captives. He doesn't say that we're the local officials that have authority. He doesn't say that we're the soldiers that can acquire more and more and more things for themselves. Paul tells us that we are the captives. We are the people walking towards their death. Every single step we take is one more step in which this aroma of the knowledge of who God is and his glory is being seen. As we journey towards our death, we're actually taking steps towards self-denial. We're giving away our rights so that Christ can be glorified. And Paul is trying to encourage the church in Corinth to live centered on Christ's resurrection, because Paul knows that this church is persecuted. He knows they're the 1%. He knows that even just trying to live as an ordinary Christian, that they're gonna rub up against brokenness. They're gonna receive some words that aren't so kind. And Paul is reminding them, he's saying, man, when you live this way, when you live boldly, centered on Christ's resurrection, it can be hard. You're walking towards a way of selflessness, but you're ushering in the knowledge of the glory of God. And Paul is reminding them and encouraging them in all of this. And it's when we live centered on the resurrection, it's not just how we live individually, but being centered on the resurrection, this is the backbone of the church. This is the why behind everything that the church has ever done. It is because Jesus lives. That first morning, when the three women went to the tomb and it was empty, that first morning where we heard for the first time that our God had not just come to cancel our debts, but to invite us into a way of life, of freedom. The first disciples and the first followers of Jesus, they started worshiping. And then they met the next week on that same day, the same time. And they kept worshiping. And then they met the next week after that. And you are here because the disciples and the followers of Jesus were centered on the resurrection, that no matter what was happening in the world, they chose to worship God. You are sitting here tonight because we have forerunners in our faith who have gone before us, who had said, I know that I may be looked at differently for worshiping God, but I am centered on who he is, and I'm gonna worship. That is why we're here tonight. The resurrection isn't just about us individually, but it is about the life of the global church. And Paul is encouraging this church to look beyond their present circumstances and to live in the way that God has called them to live. And the question is, are you willing to be a captive? Are you willing to take another step? Another step in losing yourself and saying no to your own desires, but giving the glory to God? This is the question. And if we flip over to chapter 4, Paul is gonna give us another way that we can be encouraged, because it's not just about the work that God does, it's also about who God is. And Paul is encouraging us to be centered on who Christ is as a person. He's asking us to be centered on who Christ is in his character. So if you're in verse 7, Paul writes that we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed, perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not abandoned, struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that his life may also be revealed in our mortal body. So then death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. Paul is explaining to us who Jesus is by also explaining to us who we are. And Paul tells us that we are jars of clay. Have you ever gone to TJ Maxx and looked at the mug section? It's like one of my favorite aisles, right? They got so many types of mugs. They got like a 6-ounce mug and a 24-ounce mug. They always have like a holiday themed mug. They always have a weird mug with a dog on it. And I don't know how, but they always have a mug with a Ninja Turtle on it, okay? And if you keep walking down this aisle, you're gonna come to a shelf that's kind of at the end of the row. And this is where they keep all the mugs that didn't make the cut. Right? Either they got shipped to the store and they were a little bit scuffed or a little bit damaged, or someone in the store picked it up and dropped it, and so it's now on this back shelf. And they're still trying to sell it, but it's not as pretty as the other ones that was on this back shelf. Paul is telling us that we're not even like the nice looking mug, we're the mugs that are on this back shelf. And we're on this back shelf because we're fragile. We easily break. We can be hurt. We experience pain. And it's not because we're weak. It's not because we don't have anything of value. It's actually because we are valuable. If your family owns china, right? It's this valuable set of dishes that can be easily broken. And so it's brought out on special occasions. But it doesn't mean it's weak. China is worth a lot. And in the same way, we are the mugs on the back shelf. My youth pastor growing up, he was kind of a weird guy, but he always told us that you could throw a Nalgene water bottle off of a roof and it wouldn't break. All right, so this is nothing special, it's just like a piece of plastic. And one day we didn't have a game at youth, and so he climbed up to the top of the roof of the church and just like threw a Nalgene water bottle off of it and it didn't break. That was our game. And one of the lies the world tries to tell us is that we're a Nalgene water bottle, right? That we can be thrown off of a roof and we won't be scuffed, we won't be scraped, that we can go through life not being damaged by anything, that we are strong, that we don't need help, that we don't need anyone. But to believe that we are a Nalgene water bottle is to believe that we don't need God. And if I were to come and ask you, do you need Jesus? Most of you in this room would say yes. But if we were to look at our lives, does your life say the same thing? Does your life show that you desperately need God? By your actions, by the ways you spend time with him, by the ways you talk to others, do your actions show that you need God? Because guess what? When we choose to live as a fragile mug, it's saying, I can't do this on my own. It's recognizing where we end and where Christ begins. To keep Christ at the center of our lives is to be confronted with this truth. It means that we have to trust him. We have to trust that even though we are fragile, that we're going to experience pain, that we're not going to be destroyed. Paul even writes, like, we are hard-pressed, we are surrounded, we are going through all of these things, but never once were we destroyed. Never once did it ever go too far, because God was with us and we can trust him. And to keep Christ at the center is to remember that he is more. He's more powerful than any person, than any being. He's more loving than any love that you could ever experience from someone. He is more forgiving. He is more merciful. To keep Christ at the center is to understand who he is and choose to walk in that truth. It's choosing to set our gaze set straight on him, that even when we are beaten and bruised, we're looking straight at him, knowing that he is trustworthy and true. And for a lot of us, the temptation is to do the work ourselves. The temptation is to try and be extraordinary and to get ourselves through on our own. But this isn't how we're called to function. Our job is to be the ordinary mug on the shelf. Our job is to trust that God, even in the midst of bruises and scrapes, is healing us. Our job is to go to the healer himself. Our job is to go to the powerful an enthroned king who is risen. That's our job. God's job is to do the extraordinary. His job is to work in us. Our job is to be ordinary and to go to him. And for the church in Corinth, day after day, they're just getting scraped and scratched, and it can be discouraging. And so Paul leaves them with a final piece of encouragement. And so if you hop down to verse 16, Paul is going to remind this church to be centered on what is eternal. He writes, "Therefore we don't lose heart, though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen, since what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal." We're in a time of year where it just feels like there's a lot, right? If you're in college or a grad student, there's a lot of homework that we gotta do. And I know you guys had some snow days, and so you're just feeling like that deadline that's about to drop. If you're employed or have a job, you're also feeling just like the stress of summer coming and trying to get your work done and have all of these plans made. Like, we are living in a period right now where it just feels like there's a lot. But Paul is reminding us that there's a reality that we don't see. There's a spiritual reality that is happening all around us right now. God is at work. And though sometimes we can't see it, he's at work. He is moving right now. He is working in the places that need restoration right now. And we hear from Jesus as we go through the Gospels that God's kingdom likes to work in specific places. God's kingdom is often seen in the poor and those who are humble and those who are meek. God's kingdom can be found in those who are pure in heart and those who choose to be peacemakers. This is where God's kingdom can be found, and this is often where God is working. And Paul is reminding the church that suffering and glory go hand in hand. You can't just receive glory, but you also receive suffering. And this is true in the life of Christ. We exalt Christ because of the ways that he suffered on our behalf. And if we choose to follow Christ, we know that our life has to look like his. So we too will experience suffering. But in that suffering, it will all be for the glory of the one who suffered on our behalf. Paul is asking this church to look beyond their present circumstances. He's saying, man, I know you have finals coming up, but look, I'm doing a great work among you. Do you not see it? He's asking us to open our eyes when we're at work and we have that coworker that kind of just stresses us out. He's like, I know you don't see it, but look, open your eyes. I am doing a great work among you. Paul is asking us to look beyond ourselves and to see what God is doing in and through our world. What would happen if you saw your workplace as a moment where God is working? What would happen if you saw your apartment, your house, your dorm as a space where God is moving and redeeming? What if you saw your friends and your family as people that God is still working in? Open your eyes, because he is. What would happen if we looked up from our own circumstances and saw the ways that God is still moving? Paul is asking this church to center themselves not on what just needs to be fixed in their life, but on the work that God has been doing. A day is coming when God is going to restore all things. We know that. It's been told to us. It's been promised to us that God is coming. He's going to restore all things, but guess what? He's restoring things right now too. And we're invited to look. Last year, my parents came up to visit me for Easter, and it was a really wonderful day. I don't get to see my family a ton, and so they drove out to come visit me, and we went to church together that morning. We, after celebrating Christ's resurrection, at our church, we went and stayed with some family friends, and they invited us into their family. We only knew about like 3 people there, and there's like 20 people at this house and like 4 different dogs, and they're all just running wild, and there's this huge potluck and so much ham. And if you don't know me, I love ham. Easter is my favorite holiday because I love ham. And so I'm just eating a ton of ham, and there's like this corn casserole and so much of dessert, and it was just such a delightful day. And then I went to work on Monday. And let me tell you, it was not a fun day for sure. Like, I had this job that I really didn't like. It was incredibly stressful and disappointing. I was working for an organization that I was just wrestling with all of the time. I was finishing my last semester of grad school, and I just had this never-ending to-do list of things. And I just sat there in defeat. Like, how do you go from feeling all this delight on Easter? Like, when you come into church, if you were here this morning, right, there's so many kids and like their fun Easter dresses and all this color, and it's just a day that itself looks beautiful. And then it ends, and you go back to your ordinary life on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, the rest of the week, and it's not as beautiful. It doesn't feel the same. We're often rubbing up against the brokenness of ourselves and others. Like, we're living in this world of caterpillars, and we're trying to be this transformed creation in a world of caterpillars. What do you do? What do you do the Monday after Easter? You keep yourself centered. You keep yourself laser focused and in alignment on who God is and on what he does. And here's the thing. One of my favorite things about Oasis on Sunday nights is watching all of you leave. And I don't say that as anything bad, but it's, I love you. I love it when you're here. But it's what I get to think about throughout the rest of the week, because I'm not in the places that you are. You are in your home. You are in your classes, you are in your workplace, and you get to be this week centered on who God is and on what he does. And guess what? I love watching you leave on Sunday nights, because I know that darkness trembles when you walk outside those doors. Like, darkness trembles when students at Oasis show up to class at SDSU's campus, and who continually pray for a campus and have a vision of seeing it turn into a sanctuary. Like, that's when darkness trembles. Darkness trembles when you show up to work, no matter what your workplace is. Darkness trembles when you show up in that living situation. Darkness trembles when you show up in the middle of conflict, because you are centered on who God is and on what he does. And so my encouragement to you, as Paul has encouraged a church in Corinth who often feels like they don't belong, my encouragement to you tonight is that darkness is going to tremble when you leave if you are centered on who God is and on what he does. And the ground's going to shake. Our God is faithful. Will you live as a butterfly in a world of caterpillars? Would you guys take a moment to pray with me?